Welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Featured Editor. Today I have a fabulous short, Ghost to Exist. I have the writer, director, Austin Birch here. I think I said that right.
Yep. You got
it. Perfect. I got one right for a change.
Welcome. Title is Ghosts Do Not Exist, though.
Oh, I lied. I should really write these things. Do not exist. I apologize.
All good. All good.
Well, so my notes say do exist, so I must think they do exist. Maybe
it's a spoiler, but
is it okay? We can start right there. Is it really a spoiler saying ghosts? I mean, you really have to decide if they do
or exactly. not. Exactly. I have a very I leave it to the audience to decide. Okay. At the end, would they?
We can get to we're going to start right at the end, people. We're not going to really discuss it, but I'll kind of we get to the end. Mm-hmm. Like you make me wait a long time to get here. I mean, this has got to be the tedious 9 minutes of creepiness I've sat through to get to an ending. Which I didn't want to start.
That's high
there,
praise.
We're gonna. It's very, and we get to the end, and then I wanted maybe another minute, maybe another 2 minutes, but you don't give it to me.
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
Get in, get out. It's like you say, it's the whole kind of original intent for the short and just kind of working backwards off what you're saying is I really kind of wanted to do this notion of kind of an anti-jump scare movie. And yeah, just really playing with the notion that, like, what would be the scariest thing for a paranormal investigator? And it's these moments of nothingness where they're you know, they're trying to communicate with a cursed doll or play the Ouija, and both are unmoving. And, you know, what the audience wants to happen, obviously, is the doll to move or the Ouija planchette to move. And the fact that it's not is the scariest thing in the world for this guy.
Didn't answer my question. Why did we not get an extra minute?
Oh, I mean, you know, what more would you really want after, you know, that initial...
I want? The next step. Literally part two. I want part two.
Yeah. You know, there were so many different, you know, kind of facets to end it there. But at the same time, I really just kind of like the idea that we end on his satisfaction and his answer and him confirming, and just you get the whole emotional arc there. And then I like the idea that I don't know what happens. I like the idea that, like, that's where I, as the, you know, co-writer, it's like, I'm not thinking beyond that, because we've gone through the arc with them, and everything else, you know, if she pulls him into the spirit world or, all the different potential options just don't excite me as much as, you know, getting that character arc out of Philip.
Okay. I guess. I'm going to kind of jump around here a bit, you know, because we started a weird point. When he's typing at the point, we see the typewriter move. And mm-hmm. he goes, no, none, no thing. And then this happens. The big thing happens here. Like, mm-hmm. have you already tipped your hand to the ending then? I think you have, but I still want to see it. And was that your plan to say, yes, we're going to give it to you? But I think think you were not giving it to me. And that's why I was so excited by the end.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I am very aware of the fact that, you know, people that don't necessarily like know me are going to be watching the movie. And I don't like, you know, this promise of, you know, you're sitting down to watch something scary. Give people something scary at the end of it. You know, you have the audience for about 6 minutes on Ghosts Do Not Exist, and they're buying that melancholy. Let's give them some horror, and let's pay it off once we kind of let that despair set in from the absence of it.
Okay, now we'll go with my lead-in question where I did want to start, so we'll go back. This thing is creepy as hell. Like, literally, I really want to say, did you make your act slow down? Don't move fast. Slow. Don't move everything methodical to the point I wanted to yell at your lead character going, can you move a little quicker, please? Please, do something faster. But he doesn't. And I think that your ambiance, you make this creepy as hell because of that. It is so quiet, so sterile environment, but creepy all at the same time.
That's high praise. Thank you. I think part of it stems from Adam and I kind of constructing the script within my apartment. So we were kind of able to really construct these scenes very methodically and pre-visualize the entire piece to help kind of build and create these environments that, you know, we can really live and breathe in. And our actor Robbie was such a treasure. They primarily come from a theater background, so it was really taking a performance that you can project to the end of the room in a packed theater and winding it back to almost a total stillness in the performance that, you know, you're really able to get that with a theater actor. Loved working with them for how much they were able to convey with such stillness.
I can't let you go that easy. Where did you find them then?
Facebook. Just open kind of casting call. Oh. And, you know, this was a project where we didn't have a lot of money, but we had time to really kind of develop things and take our time with casting and find the right Philip. And I think we found him. And Robbie's performance again just knocks it out of the park for me.
Okay. You did say this was shot in your apartment, so there's one question down. So you have a ton of stuff in here that I haven't seen in years. I have an old TV, tape recorder, cinematographer, typewriter, VHS tapes that I don't haven't seen in 40 years. So
Betamax.
You know, Betamax. Where is this stuff located? Where would you steal it from?
This is all stuff that actually belongs to our production designer, Malcolm McKenzie, who just was a real collector of trinkets and another collaborator that Adam, myself, and Malcolm all worked on the Blackberry movie. Same with the artist Aaron Sweeney, who did the makeup. And it was a real just kind of family affair. So when I was writing it, I'm like, you know, if I'm doing this paranormal investigator story, Malcolm has all this stuff. And he populated it with all these knickknacks that he's just collected over the years.
Okay, I do have to ask about the family photos.
Yes.
It looks like the lead actor's actually in the photos.
Yeah, so we shot primarily over a Saturday and Sunday in, I think, April. But the week prior, we had a little Sunday shoot just to get those photos and the opening scene of the movie before it turns into VHS, so we could do that camera effect to the titles of the movie all in camera and practically. So that's real playback happening on the TV screen when you go to the opening titles in the movie.
I was wondering that. I was like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
I felt you were trying to double exposure your film at times. Like you had one shot laying on another shot a couple times. Was that planned?
I'm not sure where you're referring to.
Right at the beginning. It's kind of weird. Maybe you're trying to give me a VHS kind of feel. And I'm treating it as a double exposure shot. Like when you open film, it kind of goes weird.
Mm-hmm.
You have that right at the beginning when he's at the thing and he's starting to watch things on TV.
I'm trying to think of the moment. Adam, who edited the picture as well, might be able to speak to that, but I don't think that's intentional.
Okay, that's fine. It was a great effect, whoever did it. So maybe just it was an added effect, and I just kind of liked it.
All right.
It's fine.
Yeah, we'll
kinda,
take
that's kind of funky. Okay, I want to discuss, I hate creepy dolls.
Yeah,
what okay. the hell is it with this doll, man? Like, stop with the dolls, people. I don't like creepy dolls. I don't like creepy doll movies because I just want to fire these people that will have dolls. I'm like, why are they in your house?
They are extremely spooky, and I got the same thing. They give me the heebie-jeebies as well. And anecdotally, I have a great story about this one because we found it on Facebook Marketplace. One of my friends sent me a link to the doll, knowing that I was in the market for one, and it has sat down in a church basement for the past 30 years.
Perfect.
It was made in the 50s. It's actually a wind up toy, very old and analog kind of wind up. And the plastic around its legs where the wind is all cracked. And when we were shooting, I was showing off the doll to everybody and wound up the doll. But then that plastic, edge ended up scraping my thumb open. So the cursed looking doll did end up actually drawing blood.
Perfect. I feel better now.
Yeah. So she owns my soul. All of the success of the movie is the deal we made with her.
Cool. Now, when you were setting up your shots, I mean, obviously as a writer, you have a script. I get that. But you have a doll. You have this. Did you try different angles with the doll, or you just knew that one was the one?
We kind of we would play around with it for sure. And so much of the piece was, you know, we were really conscious with our setups and finding the best possible setup for it. So we definitely played around, but we knew kind of on the day, like, we got to shoot this doll as many different ways as possible. And I think my favorite of the doll is the reflection in that, our main character's glasses.
I was going to get to that. Maybe Adam Crosby is here.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, we just got to wait now. Now, this is going to look really bad for editing, but I don't edit often, so unless I have to.
Sorry about that.
Hey, Adam.
Hey, buddy.
Gentlemen, I am ungraciously stomping into this this meeting far too late. I apologize greatly.
It's all good. We were just discussing your doll. posture. Okay, the glasses. I want to discuss the glasses anyway. We're just about to get there. Whenever I see the character looking, you always have a reflection of what you're doing in the glasses, so I can always see what's going on. Now, I'm not the greatest person. Was that done in editing? Because there's no way, or is that actually on the film and he's able to see it?
Adam, I'll let you speak to this one.
No, so yeah, that was all done practically on the day.
That really?
Was, yeah. So the reflections were something that Austin caught. I think we were lining up the first close up of our lead opposite the doll, but we were lining up like one of his early close ups in the film, and Austin like caught a glimpse of the doll. It happens to dance. Like we weren't designing the shot in that moment as such. And Austin sort of like, he caught it for a second and he like sort of dialed in on that. And then we quickly sort of like played with it and heightened that and sort of let that take sort of the like a thematic lead in terms of that moment of composition. And then that quickly kind of spiraled into becoming a bit of a visual like leitmotif that we kept trying to play with throughout. A little serendipitous and a little sort of like, you know, luck favors the well-prepared sort of vibe.
Yeah, I do have to ask about the typewriter. I could not figure out how you guys did the typewriter. Was it a straight wipe on editing?
Another Malcolm McKenzie special. I think he lined up fishing wire and surprise. Malcolm and I were talking about this the other day. I think it was fishing wire that
we used.
Yeah.
Okay. There that was. Makes so, sense. Yeah, that was the like, other option.
He tied Fish and Wear to the actual letter, the hammers that would hammer the letters onto the page. Mm-hmm. And so off screen, he would like marionette the hammers with fishing wire, and then when you pull the hammer forward, it draws down the key. It's like the mechanism working in reverse.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good work. Because I looked at that shot, I paused it, rewound it, looked at it again. I'm like, I can't figure this out. I'm looking for something. Yeah,
it was
something.
Genius. It was
I'm
geniuses.
Like, I'll give that full credit on that one. I couldn't figure it out. You got me stumped. I'm like.
Simplicity, man.
It, but I said, I don't think they wiped it. I said, I don't see an edit cut. And I looked for an edit.
No.
There was no edit.
Practical, baby. Go on,
Adam, you're a little break, so I'll give you the fast version. I found your film creepy. I love the glasses. We discussed set design. We discussed family photos. We discussed whose apartment it was. We discussed that stupid, creepy doll. And now we're on to added sound effects.
Beautiful.
All right.
So now you're up to date. I gave you the fast version of.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
The sound effects. Did you play with sound a lot here? I mean, I know when you're filming it, there's sound, but not what you were adding. But you just made it creepier. Stop doing this to me.
Well, thank you. That I give all the credit to our sound designer Steve Roberts. And our composer, Kelly Steinhoff, who both of those guys, you know, have real great ears for this and really elevate the material. And, you know, I know Kelly, I think, was telling me that he baked Ghastly from Pokemon into the score, kind of buried those details in.
Okay.
And, you know, Steve was telling me, you know, he kind of baked in a whole clock motif, unprompted, that has this really beautiful arc throughout the movie, and time sort of slows down for the character as things kind of come to a head. And it's all those guys just kind of working independently and totally understanding the assignment, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So Adam, as a cinematographer and coming on to this, how creepy did you want it? Because, I mean, you are so close in there at times, like claustrophobic close.
Mm-hmm.
And then you never give me really time to breathe. Like, I want out of this room immediately.
Right, right. Sorry, can you pose the question again? Wait, how do I know how to...
How do you film that? How do you make sure that I'm tight, like tight shots constantly? Even when I think you're gonna do a far away shot, you see him typing, and then boom, I'm right in his glasses. I'm like, stop.
Yeah,
back me up, please, bring me back.
Fair. That's fair. I mean, I think part of that is just the nature of. So, I mean, there's two things. Like, I'm big on sort of like almost cliched sort of like ethos when it comes to cinematography. Just like. Like the European model of filmmaking, where it's all wides and closes. Like that's where I like the world. That's where I like the storytelling. That's where I find it the most interesting. It's like, you're sort of revealing or not, or selectively not revealing your narrative in more interesting ways, in wider, more critically curated frames and in, close ups with, that are sort of like focused in a sense of hyper intention. Anything in between. I mean, like, there will always, there's a lot of medium shots in this film. There will forever be the requirement and the need for, and, you know, artistically creative and otherwise, the need for medium shots. But it's sort of like, it's always funny to think of, like, it's sort of like, that's the democratic frame size. The kind of like, that's why they call it, in Europe, they call it an American. In Europe, they call it a cowboy, right? It's these things that are iconically, products of Western cinema. And it's because it's the shot that showcases, you know, the asset the best, but it's not from a storytelling standpoint. I think you can get more creative and be more interesting, wise and closes. But also the thing with this film is that like Austin is like an absolute like student of the genre and of genre work in general, right? Like Austin's shorthand is in like the tropes and the characteristics and the motifs that are, like intrinsically indicative of genre filmmaking through the decades. Austin lives and breathes it. So when we were building a language for the film, Austin understood how he wanted to have us begin to visualize the story and where we felt we could, how we felt we could start to create that tension by way of existing in the universe and the geography that we were building. And a lot of times that meant being patient. So a lot of these beautiful static wides that are like, you know, arc directed with such lush density. But then lit with something that's a bit more macabre, a bit more noirish, a bit more gothic in its sort of like contrast, but still patient. And even when you're wide, when the things are that dense and there's that much to sort of like take your time and peruse and explore visually, like without the camera moving, suddenly there's a lack of like, and to pull that element of curation into the frame and to like relinquish that sort of that option of exploration back to the viewer, it can create a tension. Like when you create this brooding sort of tapestry in front of you that you know is a little obtuse, a little acute, a little off, but there's no specific camera dynamic directing the way in which you navigate through it, and suddenly you're left to have to explore it on your own, and perhaps you're exploring the wrong corner when something could be happening. Like there's a subtle tension that can build in the right viewer who's engaging in the right way by way of that. And it sounds incredibly simple to the point of borderline laziness, but it's something different to it for me. And then suddenly to sit there ominously and patiently in those sorts of frames and then drive into a close to help reemphasize or resituate or the opposite, to like counter strike with something that was intuitively out of left field. It just became this sort of like very easy, organic way for us to navigate this world. It became a language that just started to make a lot of sense to us really quickly. And that's how we, those are the tools that we use. And that's how we just found ourselves moving through this universe as far as the edit's concerned, most naturally.
Okay. Wow, that was a long answer. I forgot
to listen Sorry. To again at some point.
It was good. It was a lot of info. Okay, let's go back a little bit to the writing process because I was waiting you to get into this. You just spoke for, let's say, 4 minutes about shooting.
Yeah.
How do you only write a 7-minute, 8-minute short?
I'll let Austin start that one.
Well, I mean, Kraus, I would almost throw this one to you because it was kind of it was almost an assignment we wanted to do something together, and we knew kind of the parameters of, okay, we want to make something, and we can probably do it over a weekend, and the budget is what we can kind of put into it ourselves. Mm-hmm. So that kind of, with that homework, I just kind of started noodling a couple ideas, then hit one that I felt like, you know, genuinely kind of started to resonate with me. And I pitched Crosby a very early idea of it. And then we just kind of spiraled from there and just continued to go back and forth and craft the best version of the story possible with previs and everything.
Yeah, and you're right. It was really about maximizing resources. Like we knew, okay, so Austin came forward with this great idea, this sort of like, you know, ghost hunter is sort of legitimized by way of, you know, his position in these institutions at the university during this era when this was far more renowned. But at the tail end of his career, he's withering out. The integrity of his entire profession is being called into question. You know, just the sad autumn years of this dwindling lifestyle. So we noodled with like the script and some ideas around it, but to Austin's point, the biggest thing was like, okay, like what are our resources here? Like, what do we have and what don't we have, and how can we take this idea and how can we nest it within what we have access to and what we can execute over the course of, you know, 2 shoot days, 2.5 shoot days, whatever we can allot ourselves, to make this feel like it's punching above its weight class, to make this feel like it was in no way a product of compromise, to make it feel as though this was realized in the exact wholehearted way that it was intended to be realized, regardless of resources. Austin had an apartment that looked beautifully period. We spent a bit of time casting some characters we felt could slip right into the profiles that we had built and the era that we had built them within. And, you know, we aligned ourselves with a team that, given sort of like what they could pull out of their pockets, we knew could maximize, again, like an era and a vibe, that we otherwise weren't going to be able to pay for. And then from there, we just kept kind of like chipping away and massaging the script into a place where it's like, how can this be just be efficient? How can this be efficient and fully realize all of those little, genre moments, and move, like, and just keep moving. But at no point let the resources or lack thereof get in the way of that. And it was just that game, you know, what do we have? What don't we have? What does the script need? What can we trim from the script so that we don't feel as though we're hitting friction anywhere? And then just finding that thing where everything just sort of like efficiently fed itself. Once it was up on its feet. Yeah.
It was almost like an interesting exercise in parameters. And I really 100%. Kind of fell in love with the, you know, the notion as a screenwriter that it's one thing to tell someone like, hey, write a movie. But it's another thing to be like, okay, write something that you can shoot in your house over 2 days that you know that with the resources that you have available to you, will be the most captivating. And that's kind of what this exercise was. And I have started just applying that to other projects as well. And, you know, when you work with what you kind of have, it helps develop your voice independently and helps get the thing made.
Okay, you guys make me wait through sound effects. You make me through creepiness. You make me through the creepy typewriter. I made it through the doll. You make me wait. Literally, I was going nuts watching X's on the screen of a typewriter. And you finally give me a payoff. But it's really not long enough. So you just gave me a speech on setting up a shot. And this is your most important, I would say, of the whole short, other than setting up the scene at the beginning. And you do a basic frame shot. But it was so perfect, it scared me. If that makes sense. Like, you didn't do anything with it. I kind of liked you just sort of dropped it, and then you end it. Which is so painful for me because I want it to be a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. So what was your thought process for that shot?
That's a great question. I mean, in the initial, in the story, it was always going to kind of end with that moment. But Adam and I had a crazy amount of discussion as to what that shot should be. And I don't even mind saying that in the first draft, this was going to be the amalgamation of all of the experiments that he's done with the doll and the Ouija board. I wanted to do a Monster Squad, feature all these monsters cool. in the original shot. And then it just didn't fit the visual language of anything else that we were putting down.
It wouldn't have worked, but it would have, I would have been upset.
Yeah. It would have been a whole other day just to get this one shot. Mm-hmm. But then we just kind of started reworking it and eventually kind of figured let's end it here with our final scare. But lots of discussion as to how to execute it. And one of my references was the, you know, paranormal footage on YouTube, as opposed to actually like looking at The Ring or anything like that. We kind of realized early on in the process that if you go sharp on, you know, something supposedly really creepy, it's actually a lot harder to sell. If it's totally in focus, it's showing your monster. And Adam, I'm sure you could speak to this a bit better than me in terms of the execution there.
Yeah, I mean, to us, we always knew that we were going to finish the film with some sort of you know, punctuating, reveal, jump scare, whatever you want to call it. But again, I think it ties back to all the things we talked about, like maximizing resources. And this is like, just so we're clear, Aaron, our special effects makeup artist we had with us on the day, is mind-blowingly incredible. She's
so good.
Stunning. She's stunning. Her work speaks for itself, and her work is peppered all throughout the Canadian film industry. She's amazing. But this is a great example where, like, you know, we weren't doing prosthetics. We weren't doing, like, you know, prosthetic overlays and the eye gouge review, like removals. And like, we knew that we were going to have to build a level of like fear and a level of ghoulishness and a level of palpable terror, that needed to be sort of like partially realized, hinted at, suggested, ethereal, because we weren't able to build, tactically build with like complete fidelity, like, you know, the version that necessarily you want to. And but also to walk that back one more time is like, there's, it's far more interesting to tease the idea, to tease the ethereal, and then allow your audience, and it sounds cliched, and sure, maybe it is, but allow your audience to fill in all those gaps, to allow the audience to backfill in the like the fuzzy soft edges of the detail we didn't provide, their own fears and their own interpretations and their own projections of what goes bump in the night. And I think that's again, it's a tired trope, but I think it's one that is overused for good reason. I mean, the power of the individual granular mind is always going to vastly supersede what we can practically convey on camera. So why not use the strengths of both those things to bring us to a point that is sort of like a full realization of the intersection of both.
Okay. I did forget the phone call. I know we're supposed to end on this, but I do want to go back to the phone call. Yeah. Was there a copy of the script without that phone call? Because, I mean...
Oh, my God.
Like, I'm thinking, do I want the phone call? Like, do I really need it? Like, is that a cliche? I mean, it is. The phone call was kind of is the cliche thing. And maybe that's him just doing his final report. And I was thinking, I was asking, do you find it cliche, the phone call, or do you think it adds to the short? Maybe I'll leave it at that for you too. Obviously you do since you left it in, but to me it was cliche.
Totally valid. I mean, the phone call in my mind strictly serves as kind of setting the character up a little, like establishing a little bit more of the immediacy of the stakes.
I accept that.
But and Crosby will speak to this more, I'm sure, but that was probably the thing that we wrote and rewrote the most. Okay. All the way up until almost the very end.
Yeah. We had like multiple people do VOs. We have versions where there is no VO. Okay. It took time to kind of find the tone of the VO. The version without the VO definitely required like some complete retooling in terms of pacing. Like the whole thing just got kind of languid and like meandered. It just didn't, it lacked, it was too amorphous. It lacked too much structure. Like the VO, the phone call absolutely is just, it's just universe building, right? That's all it is. I mean,
I agree.
You just want to feel a little bit more. And the thing that you're completely right. It's a complete trope. It's completely cliched. But that's sort of, this entire film is built around, the film is an homage to genre filmmaking. And genre filmmaking functions because of those tropes, because of those cliches. It's the beautiful hook that we all keep coming back for. So if anything, like those cliches, we lean hard into them, you know? It's the bump in the night. It's the Bloody Mary of it all. It's the lone typewriter in a room by yourself. It's all of it. Like it's... Mm-hmm. Everything we weren't afraid to lean into those. So I think if any, we wanted to find a way to be empowered by them and pay respect to the way that they've been used and abused and reused over years to help define genre filmmaking.
Okay, I'm off to fun questions now. Go as long as you want. You're good to go. Because your first time on my show, everybody gets the same first question. I need your favorite film.
Austin, you go first.
I grew up loving sharks, and for my seventh birthday,
well, that was easy.
Me Jaws.
There we go.
And, you know, I was so terrified of it that I had to watch the second tape with the behind the scenes of the movie just to get to sleep at night and then realize this, there's a wonderful world of filmmaking out there. So Jaws is very much my North Star.
That's amazing.
And very much the film I attribute to making me want to make movies. And the one that I will rewatch once a year.
That's funny. That's great. Love it. My like douchey cliched answer is Barry Lyndon. Barry Lyndon is a film that I love very deeply.
The Bob.
Very dearly.
We'll have to have this discussion offline. We're going to get into Barry Lyndon.
And then my close second would be Demolition Man. Film that I grew up with, taped off of late night city TV, and you know, a young, chubby Adam with a bowl of potato chips in his lap has watched that film more times. So that film played more of a continuous influential role in just my engagement with cinema from a very young age than any other.
So yeah, that I haven't seen it.
Demolition Man. You haven't seen Demolition
Man? I haven't seen Demolition Man.
Oh my god.
I'm going to remedy it as soon as this podcast is over.
Right afterwards.
Oh, immediately.
Demolition Man. It's a great film.
Yeah, so that's a massive blind spot on my end. I'm sorry, everybody.
Oh, he hasn't seen Barry Lyndon either, I bet. So
no, I have blind seen spot.
Okay, good. One book that you fully enjoyed and helped you with filmmaking?
Mine would be Crime and Punishment.
I mean, to keep the cliche going, I'll go with the Jaws log.
Is
seminal book about filmmaking and one that I go back to that, you know, as much as things have changed from the 70s, there's still really good nuggets in there. And it's just my favorite for filmmaking.
My last question, you cannot answer Jaws, just so you're aware that you answer it. He can't.
It might be Deep Blue Sea.
No, who plays the best Batman?
Kevin Conroy.
Adam West.
There we go. Okay, guys, before I let you go, tell everybody where they can find your stuff.
Oh, Austin, go for it.
I'm on Instagram as Stindler, and you can visit my website, austinbirch.com. For a little catalog of my work. My email's up on there too. If you want to reach out and say hi, you're more than welcome.
And I'm on Instagram at @the_Croz, CR0Z. And AdamWCrosby.com will be my site. Like most, I'm atrocious at updating all of my socials, but they're there. AdamWCrosby.com and _the_Croz, Croz with a zero and a Z on Insta.
Thank you for your time and have a great day.
Appreciate you greatly, brother.
Take care.
Night, boys.